At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Now, Sammy Woodhouse was just 14 years old when she met Arshid Hussain, who was 10 years older than her. He promised to take care of her, and she thought she was in love. But in reality, she was being groomed by the ringleader of Britain's most notorious child sex ring. Well, she's very bravely here to tell us her story. Welcome to the show, Sammy.
Thank you.
Now, you've, as I say, very bravely, I know you're doing interviews, but you've also put this into a book called Just a Child, which is exactly what you were when this started.
I was, yeah. When I met Arshid Hussain, I was just 14 years old. And I was never actually treated as a victim. I was always treated as his girlfriend, his mistress, or somebody that was a part of the gang rather than somebody that was a victim to it.
So how did you meet him?
I was just on my local shop with a friend, and that's just how easy it was. And he pulled up in his car and he started talking to my friend, and he already knew her. So, you know, he kind of didn't feel like a complete stranger. And I knew his brother a little bit as well. So when he said to us, oh, do you want to go for a spin in the car? Never for 1 second did I think, oh, well, you know, this man's a stranger, he's dangerous, or, you know, that my life could be at risk. But the moment I got into that car, that was it. That was the moment that changed my life forever. And I would go on to be abused mentally, sexually and physically for several years, and also groomed to commit crime as well.
That's part of the problem, isn't it, Sammy? Because he got you to help him commit crimes, which meant you couldn't tell the police about him because you'd be in trouble as well.
Yeah, really good way to stop children and victims from coming forward. And I always thought, well, you know, if I do tell the police, I might get in trouble myself and go to prison myself. But I did actually decide that when I was 16 years old, I needed to come forward just because of how bad things had got. You know, it was really violent, it won't leave me alone. But unfortunately, I was ignored.
The authorities ignored you, the police?
Yes, I made a statement, and it was actually on an occasion he'd just come out of prison, and I bumped into him in the town centre, and he got me by my throat and he hung me over the top floor balcony. Luckily, two people dragged him off, but I was also with my son, and my son was only a few months at the time. He was in his pushchair, and he kicked over my son's pushchair with him inside, and it hit the floor. So I grabbed the pushchair and I made a run for it. And that was it. That's when I knew I had to go on record and tell the police. I mean, the police already knew, you know, my involvement with him anyway, because on a daily basis we were caught together. It was no secret. My mum and dad was constantly reporting it. You know, luckily I came from a really supportive family that was trying their best to help me. And the police officer came out and took a statement, and he said, well, what do you expect? He's got every right to. You stopped him from seeing his son.
So this was his son. He kicked the pushchair over, and it was his own child.
Yes, I was made pregnant twice by him. So yeah, my son was only 2 months old at the time as well.
Unbelievable. And you mentioned your parents. I mean, they must have been beside themselves. Did they try in the beginning? I get you were 14. This guy was older than you, taking you out in his car. You were completely swept off your feet, which I think a lot of 14-year-old girls would be. At that point, your parents must have seen a red flag and tried to stop you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, within a few days, they found out about it because I was going missing from home. And, you know, it started off just a day or two, then it turned into weeks, and then I think at one point I was missing for about 2 months. My parents didn't have a clue where I was. But, yeah, my parents was reporting it right from the moment go. I mean, my dad, he found my diary. He would go out on the streets every night to hotels, B&Bs with my picture, trying to find me. And the police said to him, you know, if you carry on reporting this, we're going to arrest you. His dad didn't care if he was arrested or not. He continued to, you know, to try and find me and to try and help me.
Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. It really is. Why do you think the police did nothing? Do you think they were involved or they just couldn't be bothered to act on it?
I think there's a few different reasons. We know now that they was police officers actually involved in raping the children as well. I mean, I was never raped by a police officer, but there's court cases now, so a lot more information starting to come out. But there was this massive fear of being called racist because majority of the perpetrators was Pakistani Muslims and majority of the victims was white girls. And there was a lot of people that were scared to be called racist. And so, unfortunately, it got brushed under the carpet. And, you know, I'm not an isolated case. This wasn't something that just happened to myself. We know now that there was at least 1,510 other children like myself. And that's just in my hometown. Of course, it's in just a problem for Rotherham. It happens all over the world.
Mm, yeah. Do you think it's happening in a lot of other cities in the UK?
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, I hear so many people say, oh, well, you know, this doesn't happen where we live. People have to stop being so naive. You know, this is child abuse. It happens in every town, in every city. And it's happening on the streets. It's happening within their homes, family homes, and online. I mean, online grooming is just so rife. And actually, a majority of abuse actually happens within the family home or by somebody that we actually know.
It's really, thank goodness for people like you who became a whistleblower and brought it to the fore. Just go back to, you mentioned, I think you were pregnant twice with him. What did he say when you told him you were pregnant?
I remember telling him, and it was like both times as though a wife would tell a husband. Yeah, I was so pleased because how I saw it as, you know, I didn't see it as this massive responsibility of a life, it's a child. I thought it would be like raising, you know, kind of like a little doll. You know, I remembered when I was little and I had dolls. That's how I saw it. And I thought, you know, we're going to live happily ever after, we'll get married, we'll have lots of babies. I was so naive. But the first time, my mum and dad, of course, they were devastated. I was only 14 at this point as well, and I'd only known him a few months. And they said that they were going to use the DNA from the baby to have him charged. Because up until I was 16, I didn't want to make a police statement against him. And because, you know, what I always say is that the grooming part is the most dangerous crime because it's silent, but it's also fun. And it happens without you even realise it's actually happening. So I was forced to have an abortion. And, of course, you know, I was so young and I shouldn't have been pregnant in the first place. But it was just something that I didn't want to do because I just felt like I was murdering my baby. Mm. But of course I did it because, you know, I did everything that he told me to do. But the second time I got pregnant, I was actually in foster care at this point. My parents had put me in foster care hoping that it would keep me safe and that the authorities would keep me away from him. But unfortunately that backfired and they said that when I went into care, as long as I met him at the top of the street, I was back by 10, he could have full access to me. So I was allowed to keep my second child because there was no risk of him being arrested. So I gave birth to my son just after my 16th birthday. I was actually pregnant at 15, though.
And this is James, and you actually say in the book that James saved your life.
Yeah, I always say that, you know, even though I was so young and of course I shouldn't have been having a baby, you know, if it weren't for James, I honestly think I'd be dead or in prison. That was how bad it really was. And, yeah, I always have a little angel sent to me. he's actually the same age as what I was when I was pregnant with him. He's 16 now.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's been really difficult for him. And he actually had a relationship with his dad and his uncles at one point. So for me, when I talk about this man, you know, he's my rapist. With him, with my son, it's actually his dad. And that's been really difficult for him.
Yeah, I'm sure. Does he ask you questions about it?
Yeah, he does all the time. And first time round, I said, you know, I'm not going to tell him anything. I thought that was a way of protecting him. And I was wrong to do that because, you know, of course kids, they're not deaf. They kind of pick up on things. And I needed to tell him just to, you know, keep him safe. And it was actually the best thing I did. You know, I was honest with him. Of course, I didn't go into any graphic details. I told him, you know, what he needed to know. And I think that was the best thing that I could have done.
Yeah, I think so. He's sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, but he's going to hear from somebody, so it's probably best he hears from his mum.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when I came forward, it weren't exactly in the shyest way. You know, he had his picture on just about every newspaper and TV screen around the world, because what happened, the exposure of it turned into a worldwide story. So it was very difficult for me to hide things away from my son. And as well, you know, when it was happening when I was a child, it wasn't a secret. Lots of people knew, and we were still living in Rotherham. So even though when I came forward I'd hidden my identity, there were still a lot of people that knew it was me.
And how did that actually happen, Sammy? How did you come forward? Did you just say, right, the police weren't taking any notice. How did you do it? Did you go to the press?
Yeah, I did. I decided to get all my files, so my social services files, my police files, and I contacted a journalist called Andrew Norfolk. He works at the Times newspaper. Now, Andrew had been publishing things around the UK about CSE. And to be honest, when I came forward in Rotherham, I wasn't the first person from Rotherham to contact Andrew and try and expose it. So when I gave him all the evidence, I honestly expected to be ignored, because the people before me had been ignored as well. You know, there was a survivor that came forward, there was a few professionals. So I honestly expected nothing to happen. But Andrew published my story in August 2013, and that was it. Everything kind of just exploded, and it triggered the Jay report and opened up not just my investigation, but all the historic CSE investigations in South Yorkshire. Which I think that's one thing that, you know, I'm really proud of, is what my story achieved, and by me speaking out and telling people.
So you should, absolutely. It's very, very brave. But did he contact you after that? Did Ash contact you and try and stop you from talking?
He actually sent a survivor to my house, actually. And I didn't actually know at first that she came to my house because of him. I was actually trying to help her. I remembered her from when I was a child, so I was, you know, put in contact with the police to come forward. And it actually turned out that, you know, she was actually recording me and passing it back to him. I'm not sure what he was trying to achieve with that.
Mm.
But, yeah, I mean, nothing kind of came of that, because, you know, there was nothing untoward on the tape recording. But, you know, his family, some family members tried to contact me and my son as well since, and, you know, my son replied back to them and said, I don't want any contact with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly not been easy. I mean, one man was actually charged as well, so I didn't just have to testify in one trial. Me and my son had to testify in two trials. So, yeah, it's definitely not been easy, but I've got no regrets whatsoever coming forward and telling people what happened is the best thing that I've ever done, and it's changed mine and my family's life around.
Good, I'm so pleased. And what happened to Ash? Is he in prison now?
He is, yeah. He got found guilty, a lot of charges. There was actually that many charges against him, they had to enrol some. So he got sentenced to 35 years, which I think is actually the highest sentence in the UK for this kind of crime.
Wow, yes.
So, yeah, he's got a long time in prison to think about what he's done.
Yeah, brilliant, good stuff. And how do you feel emotionally? Do you forgive him at all?
Yeah, I have forgiven him, and some people find that really hard to hear, you know, because of all the bad things that he did to me and other people. And I didn't forgive him because what he did was okay. I forgave him for my own sanity. You know, I used to carry so much hate and anger, and it actually drove me to suicide, you know, to try and kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And when you carry all that hate and anger, the only person that suffers is yourself. You know, it's like me drinking poison and expecting him to die from it. I just got to the point where I thought, do you know what, I need to move forward. I refuse to be his victim, and whilst I still have those feelings and emotions for him, I will always be his victim. When I went to court and I testified and he received his sentence, I made a promise that this was it, and that, you know, that day my life would begin, and I meant it.
Good for you. And you're not a victim now, you're a survivor.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always say, well, actually, you know, a victim is somebody that's still there, a survivor that's somebody that's overcome it, and then you have the thriver stage and somebody that's thrived from it. And I honestly feel like I'm in that thriver stage now.
Yeah.
If you I've had that many labels.
Yeah, I'm sure. If you were to give somebody some advice, if they were worried that the child could be being groomed, maybe a youngster was going out with an older man, what advice would you give? What should they be doing? Should they be taking notes of registration numbers and things?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the first thing that they need to do is tell the police. Yeah, this is a crime. The police need to know about it. And these people need to be stopped. But yeah, one thing that can be really useful is keep a diary. Any information, you know, you've seen, who is it, descriptions, car registrations, if you find mobile numbers or text messages, you know, if it's happening to your child, anything, you know, if they're going missing. And when you are reporting it, get incident numbers. What officers have you spoken to? In fact, I've actually got a website, and set a website up to help people in these circumstances. It's called sammywoodhouse.com. Mm-hmm. Got some advice on there on what information you can keep. And also, it's got a different range of support services. You know, when you go through this and when you're a victim of this, a lot of people turn to drugs, drink, eating disorders. So there's a little bit on there for everybody.
Great stuff, sammywoodhouse.com. And I believe you're also campaigning for Sammy's Law?
I am, yes. I suppose Sammy's Law is two things. I'm asking for something to be put in place where children can't be charged if they are being groomed or forced to commit a crime. Say, for example, somebody puts a gun to someone, a child's head, says, go do that. It shouldn't be for that child to be punished. It should be the perpetrator. Also, for people that have already received that criminal record, for them to be looked at as an individual and you know, to work around what we can do in time. Say, for example, if I went for a job interview, I would have to sit there and disclose my abuse and what happened to my employer to get a job. People don't want to keep reliving that. I mean, I'm self-employed now, and I went to my accountant a few weeks ago, and he asked the question that he has to ask everybody, have you got a criminal record? And, you know, it's his job, he has to ask it, of course he does. But it kind of, for me, just feels like victims can never get away from it. You know, people want to move forward. They want to, you know, leave what's happened to them in the past. And it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I mean, it's a lot harder than, you know, it sounds. I understand that, 'cause of course we have to safeguard other people. And unfortunately, some people, when they are going to commit crime, they do actually go on to be offenders and perpetrators. So there is lots of things to consider. But, you know, what I always like to make clear is a child is never to blame. A victim is never to blame. Mm,
yeah, wise words. Well, I think you're very, very brave, very inspirational. Your book is called Just a Child, Britain's Biggest Child Abuse Scandal Exposed, out on the 19th of April. So it's out now. We can buy it now.
It is, yeah. It's had so much support. Everyone's been absolutely amazing. So, yeah, a big thank you to everybody that's been supporting me in the book.
Well, thank you for being brave and coming on the show. I'll just mention again, your website is sammywoodhouse.com. We do want to campaign for Sammy's Law. And I'd just like to say, I know you had your childhood stolen from you, but it seems like you're going on to have a wonderful life. So you take care, Sammy, and give my best to James.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.